This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey everyone, I'm Bruce Bozzi. Thanks for pulling up a chair today on Table for Two. We're back in my hometown, New York City, and I could not be more excited for our lunch at the Carlyle Hotel, a new location for the show, but a classic city spot that's as glamorous as they come.
Do you eat here a lot since you live in the neighborhood?
I do. I hear a decent amount. I hear this morning.
We're having lunch this afternoon with someone who might be one of the sharpest people I know. It just so happens that he's also incredibly funny. He's both the co-anchor of Weekend Update and the head writer for Saturday Night Live. He's also married to arguably the biggest movie star in the world.
You always need fries. Yes.
Need's an interesting word. You need fries.
You need fries, right.
Fries are the absolute most addictive one for me.
That's right. We're having lunch with Mr. Colin Jost. We're going to talk about growing up in Staten Island, SNL, and so much more. So pull up a chair, grab a glass of rosé, and enjoy, because today's lunch is going to be a lot of fun.
Did you say a Caesar salad with lobster?
Yeah.
Whoa.
I'm Bruce Bozzi, and this is my podcast, Table for Two.
We're sitting with an incredibly talented man, funny man, smart man.
Wow.
Person I have the luxury of calling friend, Mr. Colin Jost. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my God.
I only came to hear that introduction now. I'm leaving. I just needed an ego boost.
You
and
did?
And then I'm out.
You know, your wife was the first guest on Table for Two at Via Carota way back when, so this sort of makes sense.
It's come full circle. As long as I do better than her, I'm happy.
It's all about competition. She did good.
Oh, no.
Let me tell you, she really did.
Damn it.
She owned the room.
Damn it.
I have a feeling, though.
Yeah, we're going to meet. I'm going to befriend everyone in this restaurant by the end.
Yeah, yeah. So what I loved about with Scarlett and I bonded is we're all New York kids.
Yeah.
Different boroughs.
Yeah.
Growing up in Staten Island, what was that like? I mean, you lived on a block with your whole family, so family is very important to you. And how did that mold you to the man you grew into?
Yeah, you know it. Obviously, you have a similar with your family.
Yeah.
I mean, and then when you have kids, you realize the value of that on a whole other level. You're like, oh my God, it's so nice. The idea that you could just let them go out of the house and they would run to another house that your family's in, you know,
yeah.
like your grandparents or your cousins are in. You know, that's so valuable. And I kind of miss it now. I mean, I love growing up in Staten Island. I found it very idyllic as a kid. You had lots of sports, you know, facilities, lots of parks. I was at a swimming pool that was in the Great Hills area that I spent every single day of the summer there. I would get dropped off at 8 a.m. and I would leave at 9 p.m.
Wow.
And I had a lot of independence and autonomy.
Right.
Like my parents would be there sometime, you know, in and out. But, you know, you were with a swim coach or you were with other friends or some parents would rotate keeping an eye on you. but you had a lot of room to operate, and everything was there. Basketball courts, racquetball courts, right. Everything, you kind of ran around. And now when I think about that, being in the city, it's so hard to find that. It's basically impossible.
Yeah.
And especially with space where you could get into kind of adventures. Mm-hmm. You could get into trouble, but not really bad trouble.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like wander in the woods, but hopefully nothing weird out.
Yeah.
Like
no, exactly.
A good balance.
Exactly.
And Staten Island had that. And you could walk around your neighborhood and you'd see friends and you'd see people you know, parents of friends you knew. And it felt like that's why my mom still lives there. My mom's been there her whole life. Like, we grew up next to my grandparents. She just moved to the house next door.
Which is amazing.
Amazing. Insane. First of all, it's like a sitcom setup.
Yeah.
And also, I keep thinking now of my dad. Because if you think, it's like for my mom, right. I'm like, oh, how great. For my dad, right. It's like, it's so weird that your in-law just like walks into your house
any
time of day.
It's like a Ray Romano.
It's a full everybody loves Raymond. Yeah.
Right, right.
And, but it's, you know, it's a great, I think it's a great way to grow up. And I loved it. And then there's it's definitely an insular place. It's literally an island, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, you know, some people commute into work. So they're all the time, you know, I commuted into high school. So I was naturally there all the time.
Right.
And then you just see other parts of the city and you get kind of, you have an itch to go get into Manhattan,
yeah.
and kind of see other stuff.
The idea that you can sort of walk out your door and have your adventures,
yeah.
and spend your summers there and have your buddies, but also have like your aunts and your uncles and your grandparents, to like how it forms you as a person.
Well, part of that is like my mom's side is mostly Irish. You know, it was there. A lot of them were in the fire department. And I think there's the sense of humor that comes out of that was really important, because
right.
it's kind of a dark, you know, you kind of, especially in the fire department, like there's so much life and death with
yeah.
it. And, but the people who work in the fire department are really warm and really, and I think have a great sense of humor in general, you know,
yeah.
like I think, and are want to joke around and love the community and the camaraderie.
Right.
And that's part of why they love their jobs, even though they're obviously very dangerous.
Yeah.
And I think, and maybe that's the nature of dealing with a job that's really dangerous, is that you kind of have to joke around about
yeah.
it sometimes, because
yeah.
otherwise you go crazy, you know? So that's definitely the community I was raised in, of people wanting to have fun, and no one wanted to be serious or
right.
anything. So
Staten Island sort of really became its own borough offshoot. Not a lot of people were going to Staten Island. And yet to me, when I would go, I'd be like, this is like country. This is beautiful.
I mean, it was literally real country
yeah.
for until probably like the 50s, or, you know, there were huge farms.
Yep.
There were, it's where people in Manhattan and Brooklyn had summer homes, believe
yeah.
it or not. Like there was a
Makes
boardwalk.
Sense.
There, my grandpa was a lifeguard on the boardwalk, and it was probably similar to really nice areas in the Jersey Shore.
Yeah.
And it had
completely.
This thriving beach. There's still like beach bungalows in certain areas. And I mean, basically, I guess the water just got so bad that it became a lot less appealing
to
go in the water. But
that's it.
It used to be that. And now it's a lot more crowded. I mean, that's the biggest complaint for everyone.
Crowded
who lives
as
there.
Far as people have moved in,
and
they
there's
want
not
houses.
The same. You know, the population is now probably 500,000 to 600,000. And it was back then in the 50s, it might have been like 50,000 or something.
Right.
Like it might have been a 10 times growth with, and it's down to the size of Manhattan, basically, the
yeah.
land area. So it's not so much, it's like a third the population.
Right.
But still pretty, that's still a lot of people.
I mean, you love it so much that you bought a ferry.
I did.
You and Pete Davidson bought a ferry.
That's how much I invested in.
What is there going to be a party on that?
You're going to be invited. Don't worry.
Okay.
I feel like
I ask that a lot when I'm with Colin. That
is there
I
just a party?
Like I remind him like you do that. You own that. And when are we gonna?
When is the party?
Yeah,
it's a great question. it's definitely going to start with a party. That's the one thing we know.
Right.
Everything in between is what we're figuring out. I'm very excited about the project. It's such a giant project that it's going to take time. But there's really good, I think it's a great opportunity. There's a lot of good ideas that are already behind it. So,
and I love the fact that you guys made this choice, you're both Staten Island guys, to preserve this part of history. It's like, you know, these things go away. Do you think?
Yeah, it would have been sad if it was just scrapped.
Yeah.
Maybe it might have been more financially viable to just use the steel and wood and sell it, you know? But no, it was cool. And it was the actual boat, the ferry that I took every morning to school.
What did your room look like? Did you have posters in your room? Like, what color was your room?
My room still looks exactly the same as it did. My parents have, they just like maybe changed the bed from a twin bed to, because like, well, who's going to ever go and use this twin, creepy right. twin bed that's still there?
Right.
But it was, and it's, I think it still is, but since I was probably a baby, it was baby blue wallpaper. I mean, not wallpaper, painted.
Right.
Painted baby blue, which it was throughout my entire high school, college, when I came home.
Okay.
It had animated looking poster of a penguin with sunglasses that said chillin',
okay.
that I won selling magazine subscriptions.
Okay.
That went up. There was a photo of me, like a caricature of me that was painted in Paris when I went with a friend in high school.
Right.
And then it was just bookshelves with all these books of Russian history, economics, old English literature, poems, romantic poetry,
wow.
Michael Crichton novels.
Wow.
And a desk that I would work at and a closet with some clothes. And that was it.
That was it.
I never had a phase where I put up posters of things I liked.
Right.
I never had a phase where I had like real stuff. Like I didn't build things and put them up or do art or put it up or just didn't do anything to my room. Like I was just like, I'm here to sleep. Then I go and I live my life and go to school and everything.
And I
never really thought about it.
I just needed to picture it because
I didn't make
like
a space. I just, whatever was there, I just used for what I need, you know. I would read, I would write, I would sleep, and then I would leave.
And it still exists in its form.
It's probably the same. I mean, it's almost exactly the same.
You need to photograph that.
Yeah, I should.
You really, because before one day someone, your mom's like, you know what, we're changing it. Maybe
if blow a torch to it.
It's right.
it would be very, very flammable, I'm sure. I basically have never eaten lunch in like 20 years.
Really?
I never eat lunch.
I'm so
honored. I never go to it, like never sit and have a lunch.
Right.
Unless it's a meeting or, you know,
yeah,
something very, which is pretty rare. I don't have lunch. Like I don't sit and have lunch. I usually don't have breakfast. I usually
kind of wait,
get to, you know, with kids and everything. And
yeah.
Then I maybe get out of the house by 9 or 10.
Right.
I'll work out. Then I'll have
like a juice, like a green juice
or
coffee.
Coffee.
Right.
And then I'll have usually I'll just have like an egg white omelet when I finish, after I finish exercising.
Right.
And then I'm, you know, I kind of good till dinner.
Right.
But, you know, I'll have something on the go or at work in between. But, you know, otherwise that's my next main meal.
Okay. I mean, you talk a lot about growing up and being overweight.
Yeah.
Which it was hard for me to believe. Plus, you were always so active on bicycles and then doing crew at college. I don't understand.
Yeah, it was like a paradox where I was playing 5 sports and I was gaining weight. And I think
insane.
It was like honestly a testament to how insanely caloric fast food was in the 90s.
Yes.
That I was able to maintain and even add weight despite constant activity. And my brother and I both were like, my brother was even heavier than I was.
Really?
And we were constantly eating like processed food.
Yeah,
you know,
well, that's it.
It was a lot of McDonald's. We would go to McDonald's. Right. We would each get a full adult meal. Then my brother and my dad and I would like split a 20-piece nuggets for the table. And like you often would get like one other thing, like a triple cheeseburger to split up.
I mean, that's crazy.
That's a lot. That's like each having probably 3,000 to 4,000 calories for
completely
a casual lunch.
Yeah.
And we probably ate it all in about 10 minutes.
Right. Nothing tastes better. And then you'd have dinner later that night.
Oh, yeah. Of course. We weren't missing meals. We weren't even like, no, I should back off on dinner. They made a lot of dinner. You know, my parents did cook a lot at home. And then we had probably all the things that you now realize are the worst breakfasts, you know, like bowl of cereal, like bowl of sugary cereal
mm-hmm.
with nothing else to anchor it in any way,
right.
or like a donut or a bagel or
right.
all the things that now you realize.
Right.
Are
exactly.
Like, but you know, of course, I think also at that time, no one was really thinking, certainly no one in my orbit was thinking about nutrition or.
No. That didn't come until later.
No. I talked to Cher the other day.
Okay. Can you give us some context?
On the phone, like 3 days ago.
Why?
because she was maybe going to come on and do something on the show. She basically was like, I wanted to come, you know, she was extremely nice.
For the Christmas show, like the
Christmas show? Last show, because she was doing a show at Madison Square Garden. She was doing it probably Jingle Ball?
Jingle Ball, yeah.
And we were kind of talking about, originally we were talking about having her come on, like introducing her as on Update. She wanted to do something on Update, like saying here to talk about the NBA's first ever in-season basketball tournament this year. Come on, and just give really good basketball analysis of what's happening.
I mean, come on, that would have been hysterical.
I would have, and we would talk to her. She's like, I don't know basketball. I'm looking at these names. I don't know anyone that's in this thing. You're like, yeah, right, yeah. And then
would have made it funnier.
I think it would have been, but also I'm sure maybe it would have also been deeply unsatisfying for any fan shares. It would have basically eliminated most of her fans. But she was so cool. I mean, I was so excited to talk to her.
Yeah.
I'm like, holy shit.
What was she like? Was she like
really very nice and you know, I really wanted to figure something out, but it was hard. I think the part of it being alive is so hard, and so it's also such a scary thing, you know. But hopefully we will at some point. But she was really cool to talk to. I mean, it's one of those people you're like, that's really
she is.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-errands pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Thanks for joining us on Table for Two. Colin Jost graduated from Harvard, where he served as president of the legendary humor publication, The Harvard Lampoon. How did working at The Lampoon prepare him for Saturday Night Live? When you go to Harvard and you are, you know, writing for the Lampoon, which, you know, they don't make it easy to get on that. It's, you know, to become a writer, and it's kind of great that, like, you have to.
Yeah, it's a hard process and a kind of a mysterious process, and you don't know. There's a lot of things that kind of fuck with your head about it, and you don't know whether you're blowing it or you're doing okay. Like, you know, there's very little support or structure to what the advice is and stuff there. So, and you realize you're just dealing with kids who are a year older than you, maybe,
right.
And maybe they're drinking during the day, and maybe they're not totally in a great position to be giving advice also.
Right.
So you're trying to go through this process, but it is a really, you know, it's a great meritocratic writing process. You know, you're submitting sketches, people are voting on sketches, not knowing who wrote them,
right.
You know, which I think is kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, I do too.
And theoretically just trying to find who is the funniest person, which is still subjective, but that's at least what their goal is. And it's, you know, you have to write a lot to get in. And when you're on, you're expected to write a lot. So right. It's, you know.
That's wild. So do you feel, and you also, you know, by the time you left, you are at the top of the chain in that, you know, you're top dog there.
Yeah.
And also now being, you know, head writer, and you've been head writer. And what is it about you that you feel gets you to that place? Are you highly ambitious that way?
I'm definitely ambitious. I think the head writer part was a combination of things. Like, part of it was just getting better as a writer, it's not a job anyone does. Like Michael Che, I loved him as a comedian and recommended him as a writer. But he came in, like, he had never written a sketch before in his life. He'd never written a single sketch. He was a great stand-up, but he'd never written a sketch. And then he just figured it out, like, quickly. He figured it out and wrote and has written some of the best sketches that have been on the show ever. Right. And
so that's just talent.
Like that, yeah, that's, I mean, obviously it's talent. Mm-hmm. And then also someone, you know, I don't know what it is, like willing themselves to figure it out or just being savvy enough to figure it out, you know, and which is kind of a miracle.
Yeah.
Like that someone can just can come in and just figure it out totally. Like, I didn't have any experience writing sketches really, but I would do, like at the Lampoon, you're writing stuff that's not always so dissimilar. And then I definitely performed some things with friends around the city that were kind of more in a sketch world. So it wasn't like totally and I wrote a packet. Like, I wrote a couple packets to try to apply and submit, which he didn't do.
Right.
So it's he really went from like 0 to 100 successfully.
Right.
Whereas at least I had that, like, I had gone through it a little bit. And then certainly it's ambition. Like, that was your first goal is to not get fired, right? You just want to have a chance to do it and enjoy the job and write things you think are funny and hope that they get on the air. And I was lucky that some things that I wrote got on the air. And then the second year I came back and I had sort of an expectation, like, of myself, like, I should be able to write a lot of stuff because I wrote some stuff last year. And the second year, like, I won't even say, like, the first 5 or 6 shows, like, I didn't have anything in the show my second year. And I was like, oh no, like, am I regressing? Am I bad at this now? Or, like,
submit and it just wasn't put
in the show. Yeah, in SNL. And then at some point in the second year, it started clicking again and I started getting stuff on. And then after that, it was like a build, like years 3, 4, 5, where I started getting, like, something on every show.
Right.
Then I started getting like 2 things on a lot of shows. Mm-hmm. Then I started getting like 2 things on every show.
Right.
You know, on average at least.
Just because, did you figure out sort of the rhythm of it?
I got better. I mean, it's just getting reps in. Yeah. You know, like, I was writing hundreds of sketches a year. Right. So you get better at it, hopefully.
Uh-huh. The odds and become in your favor.
Yeah, too. and then also there's lots of things, right? Like, if you start getting sketches on the show, then probably cast members want to write with you more.
Right.
Or if you're helpful to cast members who are funny, that probably helps you also. And I was very lucky to work with people who were really fun. The cast, you know, I started with Sudeikis and Andy and Kristen and Bill.
I mean, come on.
Which is essentially the best 4.
Right.
And that was the whole class.
Right.
So I think that's pretty much like per capita the best incoming class ever.
I think so.
With the exception maybe of the first ever cast, you know.
70s.
But that's a pretty incredible group. And so I think I was lucky in that way. And I think, you know, once it's like years 3 to 5 or something, I think then I got promoted to like supervising writing position, which was was really just like, you're getting a bunch of stuff on and we need to give you some title, but you're not a head writer, nor are you ready to be. So, you know, but you're somewhere you're in the mix of a new generation or whatever. Then you're just like more, you get into more the producerial world of it more. You're in more meetings with the producers. You're in more meetings with Lorne. You're getting the comfort of being around Lorne in a way too, because that's, you know, because he goes from being a guy you see in the hallway every so often and are scared to say hi to, to he's asking your opinion on something, that's a big change.
It's
and then
deal.
You're getting, and then over time, it's like you're growing. There's a friendship growing with the person that you really like and care about. So that was the bill, but certainly there was ambition. Like, that was, once I got over the hump of being afraid of being fired, like, that was definitely a goal in my mind at some point, was I wanted to be a head writer, because that was a lot of people that I looked up to were head writers, like Jim Downey and Seth and Tina and Paul Appel. And there were a lot of people that were like, in Michael O'Donoghue back in the day, you know, people that were, you looked up to.
It feels on Weekend Update when you and Michael sort of go back and forth, it feels like you write what he's going to say, like when you do the, and like he's never seen it. Like, you know, you'll see it'll pop up on the screen and then you shake your head and you smile like, okay, I can't believe I have to say this. Is that how it goes down?
Yes. Yeah, it's... yes, it's really... It's both terrifying and exhilarating. Right. Like, it's kind of crazy. There's just not a lot of live television in the world anymore. No. So the idea that you're on live television and you have to say something you don't know what it is, that's pretty crazy. And it's not usually gentle.
No.
So it's a very strange thing but a crazy experience to go through. And it's really fun. Like, I'm someone who can also be really in my head a lot of times. You know, just in a writerly way, I can be in my head. And it definitely gets you out of your head. And there's times where things... And I really like that. When there's times where you just have to react, I'm probably better at that than when I'm thinking it through. But then you're like, I don't know how... Why can't I get that normally?
Right. If you were anticipating it because you knew it...
Then it wouldn't be the same.
It's a brilliant... As a viewer, it's a brilliant moment. Like that, your weekend update together is when it goes there, it's hysterical.
Thank you.
You're like,
it really just came out of just kind of trying something and was not, again, right. we didn't really have an idea for it. And then we just kind of tried it and it became that. And, we'll see. But it's always, there's definitely a reminder to not be afraid of trying things. It's hard at our show because you really only get one shot to try something because it's at dress rehearsal. Like, if it doesn't go well at dress rehearsal, it's pretty rare that it's going to still be on the air.
Right.
You know, so it can go the other way. It goes well at dress and then not well at air, but it doesn't really go the other way.
Who were the comics that you were heavily influenced? Because I was thinking about you. So when I was a young man in 1989, I was a page at NBC, and that was a hell of a great job. So every weekend we worked SNL. We did tours during the day, and then, you know, you had your break, and then it was like boom. And I always, with Stephanie Phillips, we had big curly hair. It was very, late 80s, early 90s. And we would work the door at Studio H. And it was like the power job. And my cast then, the cast set was Dana Carvey, Nora Dunn, Phil Hartman, Jan Hooks, Victoria Jackson, who I just love, John Lovitz, Dennis Miller, Mike Myers, Kevin Nealon, and A. Whitney Brown.
Wow, that's great.
That was a good...
That's a great cast.
Yeah, that was a great... Yeah.
I remember that. I know that writing staff was great too at that time. Like,
really?
There's so many great writers from that era.
I mean, it was a hell of a year and a half to be part of that and to be in those shows. And that was the year too that Gilda Radner died. And so, like, that was like a whole like thing in a moment. Who were the people that really influenced you from a comic standpoint? And were you always interested in finding yourself on the road and pursuing that? I mean, you also are a Russian literature major. You know, you're also a writer. How did that all form itself?
SNL-wise, that was what you're describing. That cast is the first cast that I have memories of.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, obviously loved Dana and Mike Myers and Jan Hooks. And, I mean, Phil Hartman was incredible. And also from, you know, like So I Married an Axe Murderer, I love Phil Hartman's great in that too, and,
right.
and his work on The Simpsons, like I kind of was aware of that,
right.
you know, just his voice acting that was so funny, and you know, the Wayne's World movies with Mike and Dana were those were like the early SNL people that I really loved. Then really big were really my sweet spot in high school, I guess, were, which is usually when people's SNL casts are, it's like were Sandler and Farley,
right,
Rock, Spade. That whole crew, those were like the sketches that I would reenact at school and stuff with my friends. Like, even formally, we would go do like assemblies and we would recreate those.
Tell that listener about that, because that's really funny.
I basically hosted a show in our class, which again, now you realize teachers will do anything to not teach. They're like, yeah, you should do this. So I would host a show as Letterman. Letterman was a huge influence for me. And I would pretend to be David Letterman, and I would read like his actual top 10 lists that he was doing. Like, I had books and books of top 10 lists that I would read and pick out the ones I thought were the funniest, and then I would read them to my class, just fully steal his material. And then I would introduce, it's kind of not a bad hybrid format for a show. I would host it as Letterman, And then I would introduce sketches from SNL that we would also steal and do. So my friends and I, like a group of us, Lenny and Mike Calcagni and Mike Bodner and Frank Berlin and Steve Palmisi, we would go, we would reenact them.
And, in front of the whole
in front of store. First it was just in front of our, whatever, seventh grade class.
Right.
And then I guess we were good enough that we got moved to full assembly. So then we would do it for the whole school, which was kind of cool.
Yeah.
So that was like the first idea of performing or putting a show together in a comedy way, okay. Right? So that was like one track of things. And then it was really actors that I loved, like Jim Carrey was huge. Robin Williams, you know, a little before was big. And then Will Ferrell was you know, in both ways, both sure. SNL and movies was big. And like when he came back to host when I was a writer, that was like one of the coolest things because he was a guy I loved, you know. At SNL, like so many of his sketches were classics to me as a comedy nerd.
Right.
And then, you know, and Tina and Amy also, like in an update way, those were big. I mean, Norm too.
Sure.
And Tina and Amy were, you know, and Tina on the both writing and update side was really inspiring, like seeing how she did that. And she's still like, I think of her a lot when I'm writing sketches because a lot of the sketches she wrote were like really joke dense. And they had a funny premise. They had good, you know, good performance things, but they had a lot of, like, every line, it feels like, was a joke. And it's like a, aiming for that, I think, is such a great thing. Like, to just remind yourself. It's always better if there's more jokes. And there's more, everything's an opportunity for a joke.
Right. Is that just something that you're born with? Or is that
I mean, I think some people are born probably with some inclination to joke around or some innate. Some people are obviously naturally really funny and you know, they're like, even if they don't do comedy, they're naturally funny. Like some of my friends are lawyers who are really funny or doctors who are really funny and they don't even really think of it. I mean, I never knew it was a business. I never knew it was a job to go do comedy growing up. No one I ever met worked in any related anything to show business, you know? So, but I think beyond that, it's mostly learned. You know, if you're doing and what you're drawn to. So all I did, again, I didn't know it was a job, but all I cared about and really memorized and got into as a kid was comedy.
Right.
You know, Sandler's albums I would listen to and memorize like word for word, knowing every line from every movie that he did, that Jim Carrey did. That's just setting you down a path. Now you might be that path and never find the opportunity to be involved in making it.
Right.
But I did, and that was then I was like, oh yeah, this is a great way to do it because I used to love it, and now I could keep doing it.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-errands pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Welcome back to Table for Two. A typical week at Saturday Night Live is incredibly stressful. There are new sketches to write and rehearse, costumes to design, and sets that need to be built. I'm particularly curious, what's it like for Colin and the staff to work with a new host each week?
Has there ever been, you know, the hosts come and you see them and you're like, you know who they are, and then you're like, oh, okay, like you get like, I'm sure, very surprised, like this person's actually really good, like they actually get it, you know? When it goes either way, when it goes like, oh, this is just, you know, not, this is going to be really an uphill battle. This person, it just doesn't have the,
and it happens like,
specific.
It can happen different ways throughout the week. Like you can have a host who's not that good at the read through table.
Right.
Like even maybe they're not a great cold reader.
Right.
Maybe they're, you know, their process is more, they're kind of reading it more straight and they're just, they're going through the character in their head. Because they know it's not the real time. You know, they're like more, they're more seeing the character in their head instead of performing it then.
Yeah.
Like even, or there's things like Melissa McCarthy, when she hosted, she had pieces that she worked on, she wrote, and they were fully formed in her head, but she was kind of clocking it in a different way at the table read. And you kind of have to trust, you know, that, oh, that's going to be full. She knows what she's doing.
Right.
I mean, obviously she knows what she's doing, but like in this particular sketch, she's got this all mapped out.
Right. And then she's not giving it to you at the table.
Yeah. Or it's like, you know, whatever it is, there could be an element visually that's not really in the piece.
Right.
But she knows in her head when she's performing it, or she knows she could figure it out.
Right.
And those have been some of the sketches that killed the most and were classics for her. So it's that kind of thing. Or there's an actor that has their own process. Like, you know, who can be, and finding it a little bit in the moment, or trying to differentiate, because you're reading 40 sketches
at
the table read, so to be able to make a choice in all of those, and that's something like actually Adam Driver's especially good at the table read. Like he makes a choice for all those pieces,
really,
and an interesting choice,
right?
And the same way Will Ferrell does in a but you know obviously he knows it in a whole other way, but he will find a new move for all of them. And it's really a kind of a miracle. Or Maya, you know, like Maya Rudolph come back and she'll like have a different character.
I mean,
for every,
it's like geniuses. Yeah. It's really geniuses.
They're very, they really are. And, you know, so that, and then there's hosts that are great at the table read because they're great readers. You know, if it was an audio series, it would be great.
Right.
But they are less performers in space, you know, so you're, that other part doesn't add in as much as you thought.
Right.
Some people have never done theater. Some people have never done live anything live, which is scary, you know. And then some people are, it's also you're reading off cue cards mostly, which is a very hard thing if you don't know that. It's you know, when I started an update, I was like, I'm really very good at reading, and somehow I couldn't do it well at all, and I was like in my head like, why is this so hard? You're like overly concentrating on reading,
right?
You know, and you're like, well, just let go of it, don't why are you worried about being able to read in this situation?
Sure,
you're able to read signs on the street and just read. But it's intimidating when you're not used to that, and let alone changes on the fly. Like Christopher Walken, who's obviously one of the best hosts ever, when he hosted, You would have things at the table read, and you always make changes between the table read and dress rehearsal because you're trying to make it better or tighter or whatever. A joke didn't work, you fix it.
Yeah.
Chris Walken would always be like, no, leave it. And you're like, well, no, but then you got to fix this part. He's like, no, leave it. And you're like, why? He's like, it's fine. He's like, it's fine. I don't want the changes. I'd rather find it, figure it out as an actor, know the rhythm, have the comfort with the material, not have all these changes.
Right.
And, you know, that's another approach that I think really works for him. And maybe would work more if we did that. But, you know, sometimes we get into, it's easier now to make changes because technology's gotten better. You know, like you can type in things faster. You can make, but maybe that's bad in a way because sometimes the actors are less familiar with the material. And if they saw a joke the same twice, maybe it's not as good a joke, but they'd be able to find something in the delivery that would make it better than a new joke.
Right.
You know?
During the show itself, the live show, is it daunting to look over at Lauren and see his face? At this point, can you see in his face when? Because when I've gone to the show and I look at him, and I swear, I'm like, I have nothing to do with the show.
And you're
still
nervous?
I'm looking at him like, oh my God, did he like that? Did he not?
It's, yes, it is still daunting. Or like when he even kind of shows up at a, when you're rehearsing or something, and he kind of drifts into the back of the room, you're just a little bit more on edge, and you're second guessing the like, joke about pooping your pants that you have in, and you're like, why did I do this? I wish I didn't have to do that for the first time in front of Lauren. Whatever it is, you know, like, there's that kind of feeling, but, you know, you get over that to some extent because you just realize, like, right. He's seen a lot of bad stuff. So,
yeah.
You know, he's not, and he's seen a lot of bad stuff get better, and he's seen a lot of, you know.
Does he throw things out, like, if he sees it, just maybe like one of those passing by comments that all of a sudden you go, oh, okay.
And yes, yeah, he does. And he's judicious about it because he's, part of it is, at least for us with Update, I think now at this point, he probably knows that we're anticipating some of the things he might say in a good way. Not like we're worried about what he's going to say, but more like he's taught us some instincts that we probably...
Sure.
So we're like, oh yeah, that if it's a joke that he's there in rehearsal for and sees it bomb, he is pretty confident we're going to fix it with or cut it, probably, without him having to specifically say, cut that horrible joke. So that... But he'll give like a... You know, he'll just give like a small but important note about how you're playing a certain thing or the tone or the aftertaste of a joke. Like, is that, do you really want to have that, the perception of this joke after the fact or something? You know, like, if it's, especially if it's about someone, like, is it mean to that person? And I'm very sensitive about that in general. Like, I'm not a person who likes doing things that are mean to people. I prefer to do it based on what things they do, like what are their actions, rather than about, I don't like making fun of people's personal lives.
Does not
like that. But sometimes, like, you know, I'll have a joke where I'm like, I think even that person would not be offended by this joke. But maybe they would be. I don't know. Who knows? You never know.
I've had a wonderful lunch with Colin today. I know that family plays a huge role in both Colin and Scarlett's lives. And as our time together winds down, I'm interested to know what Colin hopes to share with his son as he gets older.
You talk about family, and family is very important to you. It's very important to Scarlett. I've talked to Scarlett about her family when we had lunch, and they're wonderful. And as are yours, down earth. Is there something that you want to show your son? You want to make sure he sees. There's so much humor in your family. I mean, there's so much wit and so much intelligence. Is there anything that you, when you think of, because when you become a parent, it just, everything changes. It just does. Is there anything that you, I want to do this with Cosmo. I want to show him this.
You know, one thing that's really important to with him is I take him swimming a lot whenever I can. You know, like pool or ocean, and he's only two, and he's a pretty good swimmer actually. Yeah. Like he's almost independent swimming, which is kind of crazy. He's a smart guy too, but he's a great, such
he's
a fun
a
kid. But I like that. I mean, the water is really important to me.
You're a surfer.
Yeah, and it's always been something. I didn't love always the competitive part of swimming, but I did love being in a pool, and I'm very happy around water all the time. That's something I'd like to share with him in different ways. You know, the first thing that came to mind was my grandpa just passed away. And he was a firefighter. His dad was a firefighter. He's the one, my grandpa lived next door, and he really helped to raise me a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm really happy he got 2 years with Cosmo. In the years to come, even though Cosmo, I'm sure, won't remember that time, I'm excited to kind of impart elements of my grandpa in him. His middle name is my grandpa's name.
Right.
And the spirit of a lot of the great things that my grandpa, a curiosity that my grandpa really had, an outgoing friendliness, an ability to go talk to anyone and engage and really be curious about them, and a real joy and appreciation for life, like a deep gratitude feeling, like, you know, which you would say late in life, you would constantly say, like, if I go tomorrow, I'm so happy, you know, like, I don't, you know, I wouldn't be sad. It's all good, you know? And that's like one of the last things, like, on his deathbed that he said to me was like, don't worry, I'm okay.
Right.
And he literally said, bye bye. Like, kind of funny in a joking way.
Right. Yeah.
And that's the last thing. That's the last words that he said to me. And he died later that day. And, you know, I think that's what I will hopefully, in part in Cosmo. I don't know how much of it's taught versus in you, but you know, a gratitude and a, some kind of grace,
yeah.
I think, with people is a great thing.
Well, that's a beautiful story. And I think that I think it's a beautiful way to sort of wrap our beautiful lunch. And Colin, thank you. Thank you for coming. You're my family loves you. I love you. I love your family. And, you know, you're just an incredibly talented gift to the world. What you, how you see the world, and like the, you have this platform to present it, and you make people happy.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to talk to you in any capacity, but
thank you.
Especially with this lobster Caesar salad and the second lobster that I ordered to go. Very generous of you.
My pleasure.
A chilled lobster that I also have in a box ready to, that I'm going to have shipped.
Exactly. Anyway, thanks for everyone for pulling up a chair today on Table for Two with Bruce Bozzi and Mr. Colin Jost. And we'll see you real soon. Table for Two with Bruce Bozzi is produced by iHeartRadio, 737 Park, and Airmail. Our executive producers are Bruce Bozzi and Nathan King. Our supervising producer and editor is Dylan Fagan. Table for Two is researched and written by Jack Sullivan. Our sound engineers are Jez Cranage, Evan Taylor, and Jesse Funk. Our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our talent booking is done by Jane Sarkin. Table for Two's social media manager is Gracie Wiener. Special thanks to Amy Sugarman, Uni Scherer, Kevin Uvane, Bobby Bauer, Allison Cantor-Graber. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Are you spending more time in your basement now that it's your rec room, office, kids' playroom, or home gym? Well, you need to ventilate those spaces to remove stagnant, musty air. For over 20 years, the Easy Breathe ventilation system exchanges dirty, damp air for cleaner, drier, healthier air. Take charge of your indoor air with your own Easy Breathe ventilation system. You can get it installed, or DIY kits are available. Just call 866-822-7328 or visit takechargeofyourair.com and receive 20% off today.